I'm Hugh LaFollic, professor of philosophy at Eastern Sea State University, your host for this program. My guest this evening is David Crocker, visiting professor in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Maryland, and we're going to be discussing world hunger and development. Glad to have you with us, David.
Nice to be here.
Let's jump right into the discussion of world hunger. When most people think about world hunger, they think of the images they see in their television sets. In some cases, a couple times a day, you get a picture of a starving child, and you get a plea from someone to contribute $20 a month in order to save this starving child. As I understand it, you're certainly not opposed to our being sympathetic to the child, but do you think this approach to understanding and solving the problem of world hunger is at least incomplete and perhaps even dangerous? Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I think it's a starting point, but like a lot of issues, it takes over our attention and keeps us from looking at a more complete view of the causes and consequences of hunger.
Okay. What, briefly, if you could outline the three or four points you think are really important for correctly understanding the issue, and then
Right.
we'll go back and discuss each of those.
I think the danger is focusing on famine, where a lot of people are dying very suddenly, instead of constant malnutrition that a lot of people live throughout all their lives, but it's not as obvious and evident, although they may die from disease. Also, the trouble is looking at a cure for the hunger instead of means to prevent the hunger. Also, too much of a stress on just food as a solution, when in fact you can have food right across the street and be dying even though you see it in the store windows because you can't get access to it. And I suppose most basically we need to look at the long-term solution to the problem of hunger and not just the immediate getting of food to hungry people.
Okay, let's go back and look at each of those in more detail. When you talk about that we need to shift our focus from thinking just about famine to persistent malnutrition, perhaps you give us a sense of what percentage of people that are starving as a result of a famine versus those who are victims of what might be called persistent malnutrition.
There have, of course, been some terrible famines in the 20th century, but as we speak, there are some threats of famine, but no actual famine in the sense of large numbers of people dying in roughly the same place through lack of food. We were close to it for a while in Rwanda, and before the U.S. intervention in Haiti, there were signs of an impending famine. But the hunger problem as a matter of perpetual malnutrition is one that racks many countries around the world. So we tend to think of famine and lots of people huddled into camps. If they don't get a meal the next day, they die. And that certainly has, in the last 10 years in Somalia and other places, brought about catastrophic consequences. But there are millions of people around the world that are not just hungry, but are seriously hungry in such a way that they may die because their systems are weakened and they contract a disease. But it's not the massive kind of die out in one place at one time that we associate with famine.
Okay. So I take it then that's related really to your second point, that if you are focusing on famine, then you assume that the problem is you simply have to solve the problem right there. You have to cure it. Whereas if the problem is more profound and ongoing, as with persistent malnutrition, then what you need to be thinking about is a cure. Is that correct?
That's it. And it would be somebody that's contracted a disease that's already dying that comes to you as a doctor, and of course you do what you can, and that may or may not be very much. But preventative medicine is much more important to inoculate against disease, be sure that people have good food, education about what counts as good food and what counts as the exercise that is needed. If we apply that kind of analogy to the food situation, then we're looking ahead to remove those causes that bring about the situation in which people are threatened by famine. And that requires different kinds of economic and political structures.
Okay. All right, the third point is one that in some sense may seem very simple, but I suspect most people don't think about. The problem, as you described, that is not necessarily that there's not enough food, it's that the individuals who are chronically malnourished don't have access to it.
Exactly. We tend to think of solutions of getting food produced, and if we can get the right amount of food produced, then somehow that will solve the problem. And it isn't to say that hunger isn't importantly related to a lack of food. But there's more than just the food productivity, and we've had enormous success in agricultural productivity in the last 30 years. Sometimes people say, well, the problem then is getting the food to the people. And in a sense, that's right. But you could have the food very near people spatially, right across the street, as I said, and they don't have access to it. So that link between the food and people's ability to do something with it that can benefit their lives, including their nutritional well-being, is what I think the solution to hunger has to add, and not just the production and even the transport of food.
Okay. Could you say a little bit more about what you mean by people not having the access to the food?
Well, if you don't have enough money in your pocket to buy the food that's for sale, then you may suffer from malnutrition or even from a more dramatic collapse because you can't gain control over it. You can't get it into your possession, which enables it to make a difference in your life. Or you may not be able to purchase the seed and the fertilizer or whatever that enables you to plant the food, the seeds that will result in the food that can feed you and your family. Or your tribe may have fallen on bad ways and not have food available. Or your government may have decided we're not going to provide food stamps for people anymore because they ought to be able to do that on their own. They ought to be able to make a good living and be able to buy their own food. And of course that's an issue that's emerging in our own national debate right now about whether a government has any responsibility in that way. There's different ways in which people can gain control over food or gain access to it. The problem then is whether people have any of these ways available to them or not.
All right. All these problems then, I take it, on your view, are very closely related to the issue of development. That if we were more concerned about what you want to call development, and I want you to explain that in a minute, that we would naturally be more concerned about preventing hunger rather than curing it. We would be naturally concerned more about persistent malnutrition than about famine. We'd be naturally concerned about people's access to the food.
Exactly.
So in some sense, the key to the whole issue is, as I understand your view, is that it's related to development. You want to give us, well, first of all, is that true? And if so, do you want to give us a brief account of what you mean by development?
Yes, but it's important right away to go on and say what you mean by development. When most Americans hear the word development, they think of a developer that's going to bring in a suburban development project in the neighborhood or in an adjacent neighborhood. And when we're talking about development internationally, maybe it would be better to use beneficial social change as a synonym to get the idea that what we're talking about are long-term changes in the basic structures of the society, the government, the way the market functions, the way private voluntary organizations function, that enable people to have access to a reasonably decent life. And those are sometimes very difficult changes to bring about because there's lots of obstacles in the way. But when people talk about international development, they often mean those kinds of changes which will give people the opportunity to live, to have well-being in their own lives and the lives of their family.
Okay, and so you're using the term well-being rather than just being fed. So in your view, development is not just a matter of providing food or even allowing people to acquire their own food, but it's something more than just basic nutrition. Is that correct?
Right. The first thing you want to say is that well-being includes nutritional well-being. It includes a level of healthiness that is contributed to by good medicine, by good exercise, by good food, but it includes other things that we might call more social or more mental dimensions of well-being. Being able to make one's own decisions, being able to use one's reason and one's imagination, being able to participate in the life of the community. To the extent that we're able to do those things, and unfortunately some people in our community, either because of sickness or because of accidents or whatever, are not able to, but those that are able to need the opportunities to be active in those kinds of ways. And that's part of the idea of human well-being. So on this view, what good development should be doing is to be bringing about the opportunity for this kind of well-being for everybody in the community.
Okay, so food, in this view, food really serves two purposes. One is just basic basic nutrition, but secondly, that if a person is well-fed, then they are at least in the position where they can, in principle, satisfy these other aspects of well-being.
Right. And that's something that we should be aiming for, whether we're in a rich country with lots of opportunity for some people and little opportunity for others, or whether we're in a poor country where a few people have a lot of opportunity and an awful lot of people have very little in the way of chances to live a good life.
Okay. Let's pause just briefly to welcome any visitors, any listeners who might be joining us right now. I'm Hila Follett. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest this evening is David Crocker, who is a visiting professor in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Maryland, College Park, Maryland. And we're discussing world hunger and development. You've been arguing that we need to put more emphasis on development if we're going to solve the problem of hunger. Certainly one thing that I can imagine a listener might say is, you know, why are these people starving? Aren't they starving because they're having too many children? Aren't they starving because they aren't industrious enough? Why should we, in better off countries, give, in some ways, help them develop their countries and to feed themselves if the problem is of their own making? What do you say to that?
Well, there's some truth in it, because we know people in our country, and if we visit other countries, we have the hunch that there are some people that could, on their own, do a lot more than they're doing. And for one reason or another, they are not doing it. Now, what might the reasons be? Sometimes they're kind of systemic reasons, where forces outside their control, for example, inflation. Very rapid inflation means that the money that they have in their pockets, that they have earned through the sweat of their brow, just isn't adequate to purchase the food that they need in order to stay above the line of subsistence. And unfortunately, that's one of the problems that has happened around the world, is that even though there's enough food available in the country or even in the region or even in the village, that there are some people who don't have the purchasing power to get it, not because they haven't been provident and saved for the future, but because of forces, economic forces, that could have been predicted. Sometimes this happens because there's not a sufficiently open society in which possible food and hunger problems could have been identified by a vigilant press or by journalists like yourself who sense something is going on and go to get a story and make it impossible for officials, local, state, national officials to ignore the situation. It's interesting here that India has never had a famine since independence in 1947, while China has had famines. What's the difference? By the way, famines in China in which 30 million people died. The difference I think the best explanation is that in spite of India's great poverty, it's had a reasonably democratic society with a free press that has gotten on top of issues before they've gotten out of control. So again, we come back to there may be these systemic kinds of issues. But even if we grant that there are some individuals who could have seized opportunities and failed to do so, what about their children? Their children aren't responsible, at least the young ones. Although, by the way, sometimes it happens that children have to go to work and have to give up their schooling in order to keep their parents alive. But young children, we believe that something ought to be done, even though their parents were negligent, to provide them with an opportunity for a decent life. Why should, just because you're born in a family that's been irresponsible, why should that deprive you of an opportunity at least to have a minimal level of well-being?
And I take it, too, that most of the people in the world who are victims of chronic malnutrition are, in fact, children.
Exactly. Children and often women who have been involved in families in which the woman eats less and eats less, and haven't been able to keep above the level of reasonable subsistence.
Okay. Well, now you've identified the problem. You've said that we need to focus more on development. Let's get specific. I mean, what should, on your view, what should individual citizens in this country do? I mean, are you opposed to people sending $21 to the Christian Children's Fund? Or do you think there are better ways that they could spend their money? Would you suggest that people make effort, different sorts of efforts, political efforts, for example? What would your suggestion be?
I think one of the ways in which people can help, there are groups like Oxfam, for example, groups that have a very good track record of not only getting food to the people that need it, but getting the food to the people that need it in such a way that they provide longer-term opportunities as a follow-up to the short-term solution. For example, work opportunities. What we need to look for is ways when there is a dramatic situation of malnutrition or famine, if that happens again in our world, to link our famine aid to our longer-term development assistance. And by the way, not only in other countries, but in our own country. There are areas in the United States which are racked with poverty and malnutrition, not famine. But again, on this view, the lack of opportunity is a problem in this country as well.
Okay. Now, that the suggestions there, though, are more policy suggestions, I suppose. I mean, what the way the government should proceed. Are there specific things? I mean, suppose a listener out there says, I'm very concerned about world hunger. I've heard what Professor Crocker has said. I want to do something to help countries develop in the ways in which he's talking about. What do they do?
One of the organizations in our government that is doing, I think, excellent work in this regard is the Inter-American Foundation, primarily concerned with Latin America, where their concern is to help bring about a kind of community-based grassroots development that opens up economic opportunities for people and tries to ensure that people become reasonably self-sufficient on a communal basis. They have not gotten the kind of funding that they've needed in the past. So one political act that a citizen can play in the midst of our privatization and cutting back in Washington on so many programs is to insist that the kind of development efforts that really make a difference in people's lives be not victimized by our current attempts, and reasonable attempts in many cases, to balance the budget. There are certainly other ways, depending on one's age and one's interests. I'm a believer in the Peace Corps, for example. Not every Peace Corps project has done the right kind of thing to bring about the kind of development that I'm talking about, but many of them have. And many Peace Corps volunteers today are in their 50s and in their 60s, bringing skills to people in various parts of the world that need them desperately for this kind of long-term project. There are other kinds of things that communities can do. Sister cities. There are many communities in Nicaragua that are still racked by poverty and by basic institutional failure after many years of civil war and now neglect by international organizations. Matagalpa, a city in northern Nicaragua, is a sister city to a city in Colorado, where basic transfer of not just money, although sometimes that's very important, but technical assistance, educational assistance. I think we need to explore all sorts of ways, not just through our government, in which citizens and communities can interact together, and sometimes will gain from what we learn and working with them that we can reapply to our own situation in this country.
Okay. Well, in one way, what you're saying is might be disconcerting to a listener. I mean, one of the nice things about the appeal of sending your $21 a month to an organization like the Christian Children's Fund is a person could say to themselves, well, gee, I've done all I need to do. I've made my basic contribution. I've fed my child in another country. That's the end of the story. I've fulfilled whatever reasonable obligation or responsibility I might have. I take it part of what you're saying is, since the problem is very complicated, the solution is also going to be complicated. You aren't going to solve the problem simply by sending money to a group, but by trying to be involved in your community in certain ways, certain political activities. Am I hearing you?
Yes. And I think that a complex problem with complex causes requires a complex solution. Another that I didn't mention, a group like Bread for the World in Washington, D.C., is primarily a legislative lobbying group that's trying to bring about the kind of changes in legislation and in the Agency for International Development and in other arms of the U.S. government that can give more of a likelihood that our tax dollars that are used and our private donations that are used will really get to the people that need it. It is interesting that most Americans are in favor of aid, even either private aid or public aid, food aid and other kinds of aid, medical aid, if the people that need it get it. I think our reservation is that often the aid never gets to the people that need it. So I think we need to be selective, and that requires some education about which groups are the most reliable in making not just a short-term difference in somebody's life so that they feel satisfied today, but they're just as bad off in a couple of days, but longer-term efforts.
Aimed at development.
At long-term development.
Right. Well, let me ask you, related to all this, is I know that you're very active. In fact, I'm not sure of the exact title. I want to say executive director or president of a group called IDEA. Would you tell us a little bit about the group, exactly
sure.
What it stands for and what it does and how it's related to this whole issue?
Well, the group is IDEA in English. We often pronounce it IDEA because it was founded in Central America, in Costa Rica, in 1984. It's 10 years old, a group of about 500 philosophers, development theorists, whether sociologists or economists or political scientists or nutritionists, but also policy people, people involved in the government, people working in non-governmental organizations, representatives of grassroots groups, people who are convinced that development is not just a technical issue, and it's not just a matter of strategy, but a matter of bringing about good goals for people, and that needs to be not just a interdisciplinary activity of different academic disciplines, but it needs to involve lots of different kinds of people working on different parts, because the development solution is itself a complex solution.
Well, I take it too that one of the things of your group is it's not just the people from the first world, it's not just Americans, but in fact a large number of the members of your group are from outside the United States.
That's correct. We believe that one of the problems has been a lack of understanding of the issues as they emerge in a very different cultural context. And one way to overcome that is to be sure that that Northerners, people who are Europeans or are North Americans, are in ongoing dialogue and interaction with people coming out of a very different cultural context. We said the third world, now we're more inclined to say the South, but of course in some sense the South is in the North and the North is in the South. So we're talking about being sure that the things that divide us in terms of wealth and opportunity not divide us in terms of our ability to solve some of these global problems together.
And that's related to your general idea too, that development, whatever development means, it can't mean what Americans think that it means. That the very idea of development has to be defined in an important sense by each country.
That's right. Development is one of those words that you can mean a lot of different things by, and whenever somebody uses a word, it's always good to say, well, what do you mean by development? A lot of people just mean economic growth. But just like having food available, just having economic growth in and of itself is not going to do it. At best, it's a means. A means to what? Well, hopefully a means to human well-being. But for that to happen, it's got to be structured in such a way that people will really benefit from it. And not just a few people, but the overwhelming majority of people. Hugh, I would like to add one point in closing. We've stressed what a big problem this is and how complex the solution must be. But there are some things that we've learned in the last 30 years about the reduction of hunger. And I think people should realize that in a sense, the poor need not be always with us, because there are steps that can be taken, practical, concrete steps, that will significantly reduce the number of hungry people in the world and give them, or enable them to give themselves, much more in the way of good opportunities for living well.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us. I've been talking this evening with David Crocker, visiting professor at the School of Public Affairs at the University of Maryland. We've been discussing world hunger and development. This has been Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good evening. Thank you.